Another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we visit with Susan Carpenter. Back with us, she's the Senior Outreach Specialist, Native Plant Gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. We'll talk about pollinators, native plant gardening, find out what's been going on at the Arboretum, and hope you'll join in with your comments or questions. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Susan Carpenter, welcome back. Good to have you with us. Susan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Well, let's having a little issue here. Susan Carpenter, are you with us now?
Hi, Larry.
Hi, it's good to have you here. Why are let's talk about bumblebees just to begin with, and
sure.
I think bumblebees are some of gardeners' best friends, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very, very effective pollinators, and they're generally not, they don't bother us very much as gardeners. They kind of go about their business. They have small colonies, so they're not protecting, they're not very protective or aggressive. So around the middle of April, we'll start to see them emerging from the queens, emerging from their winter overwintering sites, and they'll be out they'll be out flying around and finding flowers and starting up those colonies. So
are they?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We do have a really wonderful project in Wisconsin that people can join and learn more about bumblebees and also help share their sightings. So Bumblebee Brigade is the place to go, and that is a DNR project which allows you to enter your to submit your pictures of bumblebees, and it's really fun to take pictures of bumblebees and learn more about them through that project.
Are they a lot different from other pollinators? Do they go about their business in the same way, or?
Well, there are so many different kinds of pollinators, of course, and actually so many different kinds of bees. We have probably 500 different kinds of bees in Wisconsin. These are native bees. So all different lifestyles, but the bumblebees are they're familiar to people, so we recognize them easily. And there are many kinds. There's 20 different kinds in the state, so you can, learn a lot about them and about their different color patterns and how to recognize them and their behavior and which flowers they visit. So they usually they can visit flowers that other bees can't visit. They can pollinate flowers that other bees can't really pollinate, just due to the large size and due to their, their strength in getting into some of those hard to enter flowers.
All right, Susan Carpenter, our guest today. Great to have her along. Again, you can join in with your own questions or comments at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. I was really happy to see that the Friends of the Arboretum Plant Sale is back this year. But it's probably going to be conducted in a little different way.
It is a little different, but we have some good news on that. The plant sale, we won't have the big tent, but what we do have is a wonderful selection of plants, including trees and shrubs, grasses, and mixes and all the flowering forbs. And this is offered this year through online ordering. You could do it by a paper order too, but I do encourage people to look into the online ordering. It's very easy, very convenient, and it's linked on our website for the Arboretum. I think you have that posted. And we have, and the website for the Friends of the Arboretum is foamadison.org, and it's so great. The pictures are right there. The ordering is just a wonderful, smooth experience. And these, your orders that need to be in by March 15th, but then the curbside pickup for the smaller plants will be at the Arboretum in May. And for the trees and shrubs, people will have curbside pickup at the Tree Nursery, which is in nearby Oregon, Wisconsin. So it's an exciting new way to do this, and the pictures are, this time of year, the pictures on the order form are just worth a lot.
Oh, so a pretty good variety of things then.
Yes, we have trees and shrubs, so a variety of sizes and different bloom times and different winter interest, and then a number of those pre-filled mixes. So you could get a mix for butterflies and bees. You can get some savanna garden mix and a rain garden mix. We also have a couple of neat things this year we haven't had before, linking with our Journey North project at the Arboretum. And Journey North is a project, another citizen science project, where people can submit their sightings of monarchs and hummingbirds and other, you know, phenomena that happen on a seasonal basis. And so Nursery has partnered with us to create some plant packs that go along with monarchs and hummingbirds. So those would be specific. If someone's a big fan of hummingbirds, they can order those plants all put together into a kit, and they'll also get a sign that shows that their garden or their planting is part of a larger project, and so you can share that information with neighbors and people walking by. So that's kind of a neat feature we have this year, two of those kits that are available.
I love that idea. I think that's great. Well, let's give our listeners a chance to join in again, 800-642-1234, or email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm surprised we haven't gotten calls yet, but we will have them pretty soon.
Has spring fever.
Oh, there's some people coming online, so we'll get to them in a minute. But the Arboretum has just been designated as a National Historic Landmark by the National Park Service. What does that mean for the gardens?
Well, that is a very special designation, and what it is based on is a period of historical significance between the 30s and the 60s, where really we saw at the Arboretum the establishment, but the growth of the idea of ecological restoration and all of the restoration work that went on through that period, which was also, and also a lot of research that went on during that period, and a lot of development of the ideas that now we would call outreach and education and fostering Aldo Leopold's land ethic. So it's really an honor for us. It was a long time coming. It's a very involved process, and we had wonderful help with consultants who, pulled together all that historical material and presented it. And we're just thrilled that it has finally, that this designation is finally here.
So that gives us a little cachet to the Arboretum, I guess.
Well, it really shows how the past shapes the present and the future. So, while it's a historical designation, it certainly echoes and, brings forward all of the things that we are currently working on and all the things that we are planning to work on as we move, as we move forward.
Back to bumblebees for a minute. A listener emailed that a fun plant for observing bumblebees is a bottle gentian. Is that right?
Yeah, the bottle gentians. That is so true. They are a late summer blooming flower, and usually in a wetland or a wet mesic area. We have them in the native plant garden in our big rain garden. We have a number of them. And the reason it's called a bottle is that the flower is upright like a bottle, and it never really opens at the top. The petals are pleated shut, and so the bee has to force its way in between those pleats and the bees, the bumblebees can do it. They're big and strong. And they go into the flower, and the petals close back up around them. And then you hear them, like, moving around inside the flower, and then they come popping back out. So that is how that plant is pollinated, and it is fascinating to watch them. If you also can grow the cream gentian, which is related to the bottle gentian, the cream gentian is more isn't blue; it's kind of a cream color, and it actually opens those petals a bit more at the top. So when you see the bees go in there, you can actually tell when they're coming back out easily because they kind of poke their heads out and like a periscope. And it's very it. She's absolutely right. Those are wonderful plants. So if you have a little bit wetter area, and also make sure to have other plants around them. We had in the first few years that we planted them, our garden wasn't really thick yet, and the deer love to eat those. So.
No.
We now it's not so bad because there's a lot of other plants growing around it, but the deer don't find them too easily. So.
Well, let's take a call here. Jerry in Hudson, your turn. Hi, Jerry. Thank you for calling.
Hello. And
hi.
This question, hi. The question's going to be for Larry, but I'd also like to mention that my daughter and I are planning our first trip ever to the Arboretum this year. We're looking forward to a drive, but it's a
wonderful.
6-hour drive.
Wonderful.
But so we're hoping to make our first trip there. And the question for Larry is, with you talking about limey all the time, my husband bought a lime tree, of course. So I'm in charge of it, and it bloomed, had a few blooms this summer, and we have had a nice size lime on there for approximately 6 months. We have no idea how to tell when it's ripe and ready to pick. So we've got one lime so far. It's a pretty good sized tree. And right now it's in full bloom. I think I counted like 90 blossoms on it.
Oh, yeah.
And some are small and they don't seem to be developing any limes. And then there are larger blossoms. And I'm seeing maybe just a couple, but I noticed the first time around there were more blossoms than one, but a lot of them fell off. So what are the tricks, and when do we pick the lime?
Well, the large number of blossoms may be a male blossom, and the ones where you're seeing the fruit, of course, would be the females. You could go ahead and pick... I'm pretty sure if that lime, is it close to the size of what you would consider a normal lime, but maybe just a little smaller?
Yeah, maybe closer to like a key lime or something, but I mean, it's round and filled out.
Yeah, you could probably, I would pick it right now. Or you could wait a little bit, but I would pick it now. You don't want it starting to turn yellow on you.
Right.
So I would pick it and give it a, I would eat it, and then I would take the peel. What I always do, I have a garbage disposal, and I always put the peels down the garbage disposal and turn it on, and then it smells great in the house, in the kitchen after you do it. So you must be fertilizing it pretty often. I fertilize every watering. A little bit.
Oh, no, not at all. I've only done it a few times, but it does sit in a south window. It's cool in the room, and we also have grow lights on it about 18 hours a day. So,
oh, good for you.
So
well, you're doing the
okay.
Oh no, it sounds like you're doing well, and with all the blossoms you got, that's great. But don't expect all of those. I mean, I have had as many as 25 to 30 lime on the tree at one time on limey. But it takes a while. And you, how long have you had it?
We got it last summer. And
yeah,
I put it outside,
although
I didn't like the sunshine a lot, so I put it in our screened-in porch.
You would have liked it there better.
Yeah, the new leaves kept getting sunburnt. So
yeah. Well, I think you're off to a good start, and I expect that I think you're going to get more limes this year.
Well, he's hoping for a batch of margaritas, so I need more than one.
Thanks, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate it very much. All right. We're off limes, and we're back on to some native plants with our guest today, Susan Carpenter, Senior Outreach Specialist. If you have a native plant question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Christine Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network and Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Susan Carpenter, Senior Outreach Specialist, Native Plant Gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. So, questions about, maybe about bumblebees, but maybe about selecting native plants for your garden. Questions in that area. Maybe you've got questions about the plant sale at the Arboretum. I hope you'll join in. Again, the number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tom emailed to ask how he can be sure that flowers and shrubs he might purchase from a garden shop or a big box store have not been treated with pesticides.
Yeah, that is a really important question. And I think the best thing to do is to ask, to really pursue that, find out how they were produced. And if the store can't really offer you that information, they can't, they don't know or they aren't familiar with how those plants were produced, I guess I'd recommend that you use a nursery, switch to a nursery that knows how their plants were produced and that can guarantee you that. So, for example, our native plant nurseries here, either in Wisconsin, Minnesota, they will actually have right on their website, no insecticides are used. And the reason, I'll just step back to share why is this important, the neonicotinoid insecticides are a systemic insecticide, meaning that once they're used, when they're being grown up as small plants, if there's a soil drench, seed treatment, etc., of these insecticides on the plant, it's meant to protect the plant from insect damage. So the plant would look nice if you bought it, and it would be more attractive to you. However, that those insecticides remain in the tissue of the plant; they persist in the tissue. So they go into the nectar, they go into the pollen, they go into all the leaves and structures of the plant. And so then that does affect the pollinators, later on when the plant is blooming. Also, some of those, if in a soil drench, those materials can go into, it can be washed into soil, and they can go be washed into waterways. So those are some, the concerns that people have, and I think probably the listener is concerned about those aspects of those chemicals.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Nancy in Stoughton has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about flowering trees or shrubs, tall shrubs like a winterberry that would be attractive to birds in the winter, especially the cedar waxwings I really like.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of options for that, and the berries. Whenever I'm thinking about, when I think about pollinators, I think about flowers throughout the season, and when I think about, berries for birds, I kind of think about what when are they available throughout the season. I was just thinking about this recently. So we have a number of flowering shrubs that produce berries like that are attractive to birds, and probably one of the most attractive would be the dogwoods. So we have pagoda dogwood, gray dogwood, silky dogwood, and those have white flowers, and then the fruits can vary from, gray dogwood has white fruits, pagoda dogwood and silky dogwood have more dark berries. And those are very high in fat, so the birds do like to feast on those. At the arboretum, on the tall shrubs, the turkeys come to the bottom of the shrubs and take them all off down there, and then the songbirds come at the top and get all the berries off of the top of the shrub. So I know those are favorites. For your cedar waxwings, another wonderful thing they just seem to love is the juniper, so the red cedar.
Oh.
And those are large bushes. They can grow up to tree, you know, small tree size, but they do come in male and female. So you want to be sure you have a female juniper so that it will produce the little tiny cones, which look like berries, and cedar waxwings just adore those.
Do you need both male and female?
You do need male and female. It's wind pollinated, so it's very, when I planted them in the garden, I had quite a number of those. You know, and they were just small, so I didn't know if they were male or female. And it just turns out some of them are male, some are female, and, you know, it worked out that way. But you can tell because the ones that do have those berries on it probably, or the cones is really what they are probably stripped off by now because the cedar waxwings mm-hmm. have taken them. But as the season goes on, you'll see some of the trees take kind of a golden color, and those are the ones producing pollen. And then a little while later in the season, you'll see the cones developing on some of them.
Oh,
great.
Cool.
Some good
thank
suggestions
you.
For you to get started with that. Yep.
Yeah, thank you, Nancy, for calling. Appreciate it. Well,
bye.
Janet in Eau Claire, we'll go to you now. Hi, Janet.
Hi there. Thanks a lot. I've got kind of a different question. I just moved from a house to an apartment, and I wondered if do you have any recommendations for maybe any indoor native plants that can be raised indoor?
That's a great question.
In apartment, yeah.
I have not tried that. I suspect it might be tough. I have done some research or, you know, investigating into container gardening. So this would be like patio or, you know, that kind of thing. And
yes.
I have written a couple of articles about that would be searchable on our Arboretum website. It can be tricky because many of the native plants are a little bigger than what, you know, you would what you would have in your house. And they
yes.
have large root systems. Or in the case of some of the woodland plants, which are smaller, they usually have associations with soil organisms, and you know that forest environment is quite important to, you know, their success and everything. So they don't adapt to being, you know, they're long lived, they're slow growing. Mm-hmm. But that's a really interesting question. I think I would need to think about that a little bit more to see if there's something I could think of. I do know a lot of our smaller prairie plants, especially ones that are adapted to dry environments, could be used for container gardening quite readily. And so maybe I'm thinking maybe for if you had a little gravel garden kind of pot, maybe some of the very dry prairie plants could be used if you had them, you know, in a very high light part of your house. It'd be kind of a specialty type of gardening, kind of like more like succulent gardening is, or cactus gardening. But some of those might work. It'd be very interesting for you to try it and see if
if
it works. And let me know.
And there may be, stay listening, Janet, because there may be some other gardeners listening in who will call in and say, wait a minute, I'm doing this. And
that's right. There may be
indoors.
Yes, that's
okay,
a great idea.
I will, because I live like in my apartment, it looks right over, gets a lot of sunlight. But again, it is indoors.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Janet. Stay listening. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Barb in Inver Grove, Minnesota. Barb, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question. I have a rain garden, and I grow milkweed, But the problem is I get these yellow aphids, and I hate to use chemicals. I'm afraid I might be killing eggs of monarchs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that the aphids are an interesting aspect of growing the milkweed. You'll be growing your milkweed, it'll look great, and then all of a sudden it's covered with the aphids. And that's because aphids reproduce they can just reproduce them.
Yeah.
You know, a single female can just produce that whole set of aphids. So they, you know, once she arrives and reproduces there, then the plant can be covered. What we usually, I mean, this may not be, depending on how big your rain garden is and how much extent you have to available. I do encourage people to grow more plants. There is, you know, there's a chance that they won't find your plants, or have plants in different parts of your yard just in case. It is pretty devastating when they get there, though. So I know how disappointing that
is. Yeah, I have them in three different places, and they got to every one of them.
Yeah. One thing you can do is when you first see them there is you can spray it with a hose, just with water.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, hopefully that's not going to dislodge any, that would harm your monarch.
My problem is I can't hardly stand them, and I smash them with my fingers. And then I'm thinking, well, I might be killing some eggs or something.
Yeah.
But, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're usually on the stem because what they're going for is the sugars that are being translocated through the plant up to the top. And the monarch eggs are usually on the leaves or hopefully out of the way of where you're, you're doing your aphid control.
Okay,
well,
Barb.
Should plants be spread out more? Because I have them all in one circle, you know, but still they go to other parts of the yard.
Yeah,
so
they're pretty mobile, so I think if, you know, but that is one strategy is to spread things out, and because you've really, you know, identified something there. If something's in a cluster, then if one plant gets affected, they're all
going to get it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you
very much, Barb.
Thanks. Bye.
Perry in Eau Claire, let's go to you now. Hi, Perry.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I was going to say to the lady that wondered about the cedar waxwings, I have high bush cranberries lining my driveway. And one day when I was driving home, I thought I'd never seen so many female cardinals in my entire life, only to realize that they were cedar waxwings. And they come through rarely, but when they do, they wipe out all of the berries, and I never see them again for the rest of the year.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, the next thing I was going to mention had I been going on more about the cedar waxwings would have been some of the viburnum species. So great, good suggestion.
Thanks, Perry. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to Mark in Richland Center. Hi, Mark.
Hi there, Larry. I've got a question for your guest. A few years ago, I attempted to grow some sumac for wildlife purposes, and I found out real quick that the seed needs to be treated. Can your guest talk about how the process for treating that seed so I can get that stuff to germinate?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, I'll try to pull that up, but I'll tell you. Why don't I just tell you the resource that you can use to look that up? If you go to a native plant nursery website, such as Prairie Moon Nursery, they have the native plant nurseries have a great deal of information on their website about those germination requirements. So I don't have it up right in front of me right now, but if you look up sumac and you know, look up the species that you're interested in and look up the germination requirements, it may say something like, I don't know this offhand, but it may say something like C30 or C60. And so in a case like that, which is pretty common for flowering plants, flowering forbs, is whatever the number was is how many days of cold treatment it would need. Now, winter is a cold treatment. So if I put my seeds down in December and the snow falls on them and they are under the snow, then they're going to get that cold treatment automatically, and they'll be ready to germinate in spring if they have that requirement. So there are other requirements that might be necessary. I don't know what it is for sumac, but I suggest that anyone who wants to look up their seed germination requirements can do it just on a nursery, native plant nursery website. Helpful. There's a lot of information there.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Well, let's go to Kevin in Green Lake. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
Yeah, we've got an above-ground pool, and we're thinking about building some kind of a fence between the pool and the road, and we'd love to do it with something, you know, native or whatever, and I wonder if you have any recommendations. I heard you talking about dogwood a few minutes ago, so I wonder if that's what you'd suggest.
Well, there's you're probably looking for a shrub, kind of that mid-level, like a tall shrub, maybe. One thing that might be interesting in that situation, how long is the area that you're, it's like a strip, right?
Probably 20 feet.
Okay. So you're probably talking maybe, you really only need maybe two or three shrubs to, you know, to occupy that space at the most. What I suggest is doing a variety, because like some of the callers we've just been talking with, they, you know, they found interesting observations on different kinds of shrubs for different bird species. And, you know, you just have a little bit of variety there. So a dogwoods would be good, maybe a hazelnut, or that common hazelnut, which is a native. I'm trying to think of ones that are kind of a medium size now. And maybe a nine bark, which is a multi-stem shrub. So those would be some suggestions I would have for you in that kind of...
And they'd all work together.
Yeah, and they would... I mean, you want to make sure that you're matching your plant to your site, but the ones that I listed will kind of cover a range of either drier to medium moisture to a little bit into the wet side or even further. So if you have if it's a wetter area, wet soils or heavy soils, then pick the things that work, you know, for that. And if it's drier, like the hazelnut might be, you know, well-drained soil, the hazelnut might be just the thing for your spot.
Good luck, Kevin. Thank you so much for calling. Well, let's take another call. Ruth in Chippewa Falls. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, my mother-in-law had a suggestion for aphids, and this was like aphids in the house in particular, but it could be outside, I would think, too. But she would spray the plant with a very mild mixture of very mild dish soap, not a degreaser, not Dawn, very mild dish soap and water, and just spray that on the plant. And it sure has made a difference with any time I've had aphids in the house. It's taken care of them. I've never had to try to do it outside.
Yeah, that is a really great suggestion, just to add a little bit of detergent to the mix. I mean, it won't harm anything to try that for our other listeners. So I would really encourage, that would be a great idea. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ruth. Appreciate it. Well, Ann in Milwaukee, what's on your mind?
Hello. For the caller who wanted to know what native plants she might be able to grow indoors?
Yeah.
Allium cernuum. It's just the one I could think of off the top of my head, but Allium cernuum, nodding wild onion, can easily be grown in a pot. You treat it like you would treat a pot of chives. You snip it off when you want some in your salad or your cooking. And in a sunny window, it'll do just fine.
Great suggestion. Thank you so much. And it has flowers on it and will produce... Does it flower and produce seed indoors? Or
I have south-facing, and I summer them outside. I have a balcony. Mm-hmm. So if you can put them on the balcony or, you know, if you have a little patio area, then they definitely do. And it'll take a crowded pot. I'm not sure if it would indoors year round.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. All right. Anne,
great
thank
suggestion.
You.
Thank you.
I knew we'd get at least one suggestion. Thank you, Anne, for calling. Marlene in Clam Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Marlene.
Question about high bush cranberry. We have many, and they're probably getting a little older than 20 years old. They're rangy, and they're no longer flowering as much as they did. So I'm wondering, can we cut them back, and will they come back some, or should we just start fresh and plant something more bird-friendly or butterfly-friendly?
Are they multi-stemmed, or are they just one by one?
They're multi-stemmed.
Yeah, so what you can do there is you can go in, so say now, and you can cut out at the base the old, like a couple of the oldest ones mm-hmm. in that clump, and then new growth will come from below. So that's called renewal pruning, and that might be a way to kind of revive your planting there. I know it can be kind of hard to get in there sometimes and actually do that, but sometimes I'll cut them at, you know, cut it up higher just to get it out of the way and then cut lower on that branch. So that would be my suggestion for reviving it. And if you find that doesn't quite, you know, stimulate the new growth and kind of fill in as you'd like and doesn't revive the blooming, then you could always go to the ground and replace it with something else. But I would expect you could revive those with, you know, if they're just gotten rangy, you could do some renewal pruning and bring that to what you're looking for.
Yeah, and you could do it every year.
Yeah, you do it successively each year with the oldest ones, but don't take too many. Depending on how many stems there are, you would just take maybe a third of them at the most, and you just don't want to cripple the plant by taking out too much of its above ground, leaves and stems each year.
Do that for 3 years, and you've got practically a whole new bush.
Well, that's the way our horticultural gardens maintain the lilacs at the arboretum. Some of those lilacs were planted in 1935, and they're the same height as they were, you know, full grown. So you just renewal prune them to bring them back.
And thank you, Marlene, for calling. Susan Carpenter, our guest, Senior Outreach Specialist and Native Plant Gardener at the UW Arboretum. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Susan Carpenter from the UW Arboretum. She is a native plant gardener there and senior outreach specialist, so it's always fun to have her come by. Questions for her about native plants? I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got a question about that bumblebee brigade she was talking about a little earlier. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Now let's go to Marlene in Green Lake next. Hi, Marlene. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I have a question. My husband loves bonsai, and he wants to know if we can bring bonsai trees from native outside into the house and grow them. Like, say, maybe a spruce?
Wow. Mm.
Can you bonsai a spruce?
I don't know, because I have definitely never, I don't have any experience with bonsai, but it seems as though off the top of my head, if you start with a small enough seedling and you do the bonsai, you know, practices with raising it, I would think I'm thinking of a juniper or something like that. That seems like it would be quite possible. I'm sure we have some listeners who are bonsai experts who can weigh in on this question.
But I don't see, from a seedling, a very small plant, I think it should be.
And so a good thing to do would be just to see if you can find any places where the cedar waxwings didn't eat all the juniper cones. And a little juniper seedling is quite easy to find, and you can handle it, you can bare root it, you can manipulate it quite easily. It's fairly fairly robust to that kind of thing. I've had bare root junipers delivered, and then I've planted them in the garden even in fairly warm time of year, so I know that they can establish easily and well. So I think you wouldn't have any trouble working with the plant at that scale.
Yeah. Marlene, there you go. Thank you so much. Marion asked an email to ask for a recommendation for a native aster plant, one that blooms in the fall and has purple flowers, perhaps.
Well, there's a few suggestions I'd have for that. One of them would be, it would depend on the site. In other words, where does she want to grow them? So if you just have regular mesic, medium, well-drained soils, you could probably grow either New England aster. You could grow that easily. It's a tall aster and gets kind of, seeds itself readily in space, so it's kind of tall. You can prune it down, trim it back a little bit early in the season and keep it a little bushier, but mostly it wants to get to be about 5 feet tall and bloom until the very last part of the fall. Or a shorter one that would work in a kind of dry, medium to dry area of soil would be the fall aster, and it's also called aromatic aster. So it has a purple flower, but the form of the plant itself is kind of a lower bush, maybe 2.5-3 feet tall at the most, and it kind of spreads into a mounded, a mounded kind of shape. And it has a pretty good-sized flower on it, and has a really interesting scent because there are oil glands on the leaves that give off a really interesting scent if you rub them. So that one is another possibility. And then if you have a really dry site, like a rock garden or a sandy spot, then maybe silky aster would be a good choice. And that one blooms sort of late summer into fall and has, again, it's a small plant, maybe only a foot tall, but it has very large, large flowers, maybe an inch across, and just a beautiful little plant. But it doesn't do well with competition, so it needs a dry, kind of open area.
Let's take another call here. Marie in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Marie.
Hi. My question is probably cause angst for several people, and it can be controversial, but my concern is that as much as I highly, highly, highly value all the people concerned about butterflies and bees, thank you, but if you're spraying chemicals, I guess my question is, as far as the chemicals that people put on their lawn and the things they do to kill supposed weeds, those are things that the butterflies and the bees need, those supposed weeds. Mm-hmm. And how do you address that? And I'll hang up and let you discuss it without, I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, this is a great question, and I think it's something that that we approach person to person. I know that in any given neighborhood there will be some people who are very much interested in having just grass in their lawn and having a very low diversity thing, and there's other people who wouldn't mind having some flowers in their lawn, be it clover or dandelions, even creeping Charlie. And so if I think you do have choice, you have a choice there. And those flowers that are in the lawn, which just kind of naturally would be in the lawn if you don't use broadleaf weed killer on them, those are of value to insects, and they're of value to pollinators. They do have value. But if you're going to, you know, I guess the best way to approach it is just to, you know, to have the conversations with people one-on-one and just, you know, like find common ground between what you, you know, what you love about being a gardener and what they may love about being a gardener. And you may not agree on that, but it is, you know, it is true that you can have a conversation and you may, if one thing I have done is taken pictures of all of the insects that will visit a lawn like that, that's a flowering lawn. And, you know, when people realize, oh, there were, you know, 8 kinds of bumblebees and 6 kinds of butterflies. I saw this in an hour. And all these other, you know, honeybees and different beetles and moths and other insects that are all actively using that. You know, sometimes people are interested in that and they care about it. So I think it's finding where people care and what people are willing to, what people might be willing to change in order to, you know, support that kind of life in their yard. And some people might not change.
Yeah, good points all. And thanks for that call. Beth in Madison, your turn. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Hello.
Hi there. What's on your mind?
I was calling you to answer the caller's question about bonsai. And can you bring in native species inside? You cannot bring a native Wisconsin species in the house year-round. They need to have a cold period because that's how they're adapted. You could have a tropical in the house year-round, or if you have like a cold porch that wasn't heated, you could put it there and it would still get that cold period.
Great.
Also, if they're interested in having a bonsai, like a spruce or something like that, or a juniper, and they don't want to take all the time starting from a seedling, they can go to any nursery and get like a small bush for landscaping and just trim it right down. They adapt very well to that kind of treatment.
All right. Beth,
great.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Good information there. Thanks.
You could have a whole Chris... show on bonsai, Larry.
Yeah, I guess so. Chris in Stevens Point, hi.
Hi there. I have a question about the hybrids of native species. I'm thinking in particular of bee balm. You know, you go to the nursery and it comes in all different colors. And we have a lot of native bee balm, but I was thinking more like around my house to, you know, to brighten it up or whatever. I was just wondering how they interact with the native species. Will they, you know, interfere with the pollinating of, because they're hybrids. I don't know if they would interfere with pollinating of the native species or if they're just the same thing, only a different color.
Right. That's a really great question. And so so your question is, will they affect the pollinators, but also do you mean, will they interact with each other, like the native type of bee balm with a cultivar of bee balm?
Yeah, we live on a farm and we have quite a bit of native bee balm. It doesn't
right.
grow near our house.
Right.
But, you know, it's within a couple acres. And
right.
I just don't want to endanger those by planting hybrids that might cause them to not, you know, reproduce as
yeah.
much as they should.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. For the question that you're for your situation, I guess my suggestion would be to stick with the wild types of the native plants. Now, sometimes and the way that we have a lot of these variations are that in the native vegetation, there'll be a variety, you know, like for example, spiderwort. There'll be a white flowered spiderwort that will show up, you know, just in the prairie. And that's then often what happens then is the horticultural industry gets that plant and keeps it going so that there can be white spiderworts as well as blue ones. So, as far as the pollinators go, it may or may not have an effect. And there is some research now being done on different species, looking at those cultivars and seeing are they better for pollinators? Are pollinators visiting them more? Are they worse? You know, do pollinators not visit them at all? And comparing that to the original, you know, to the original wild plant. So I guess there's not an answer. There's not one answer that would cover all the species, and I'm sure we don't even know about some of them. I do know people who have, grown some of the other Monarda species. That's the bee balm, or Monarda cultivars, and they have pollinators visiting and other life, around that.
Yeah.
So that's not a concern, but for them, but. If you are in an area where you have where you're living basically in a prairie area, then I guess I would recommend sticking with the native type, and then maybe introducing some other species that just increase your diversity of native species.
Susan Carpenter, our guest today, senior outreach specialist and native plant gardener at the UW Arboretum. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Susan Carpenter. She's the Senior Outreach Specialist and Native Plant Gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. So what native plant questions do you have? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Several emails. Let's take a few of them. Andy in Madison emailed in answer to callers who are looking for bird-friendly plants and shrubs. He wonders if you could talk about pokeweed. These are very robust plants that feed many birds and pollinators. In fact, the plant will bloom while mature fruit is ripening. So he thinks it's an amazing plant that we should do a better job of promoting.
Yeah, that one, pokeweed is a perennial, a very large, but it comes up from the ground, so it's not really a shrub, although it reaches shrub size when it's fully mature. There's a native species, and there's a non-native species, and so it is a plant that we find it in our restoration sometimes when we've cleared an area, and then there's been the seeds have been dispersed by birds probably, and it comes up in those kinds of spots. It'll come up randomly in a garden or, anywhere really where a bird had dropped the seed off. It has white flowers, and then the fruits go from being green for starters, and then they come to being a bright, like a dark purple, blackish purple. And my only concern with that plant is if it's around in neighborhoods and community gardens and whatnot, that it is poisonous. The seeds are poisonous, but it looks very attractive. It looks like something you could eat. So I'm always a little cautious to recommend it in cases where there might be kids playing around or a yard neighborhood kind of situation or community garden. But it is, the seeds will be, the fruits would be used by birds, definitely. I don't know its pollinator relationships. So that would be a good thing for me to look up. I've not grown it intentionally, but it certainly is an impressive plant when you come across it. Very, very large, branching, and it continues to produce flower clusters on the plant, even though it's already producing, mature fruit further down.
Bonnie emailed to ask if you have suggestions for low-growing native plants. The area she's planting will get full sun, and by lower growing, she means something a foot or less.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and full sun, and then I guess her next consideration would be the kind of soil there and then just the amount of space, because it is true that some of the plants will, you know, spread out a little bit either by their rhizomes or by, you know, by underground stems, or they might just kind of flop over. So I think if it's full sun and it's well-drained soil, she would be able to plant some of the smaller species that don't do well with a lot of competition, maybe some of the small native grasses. I'm going to push the one-foot limit a little bit and suggest like a prairie drop seed, which might be more like 18 inches, at least the leaves, side oats, grama grass, even some small sedges would be a good choice. So Pennsylvania sedge, if the soil conditions are appropriate for those. Those would all do well with kind of a drier, you know, medium to dry soil. And then for flowers, the little aster, the silky aster that I mentioned earlier might be a possibility. There are some small plants like harebells, which is a little plant called, which the scientific name is Campanula. So that's a possibility. I mean, if it's maybe lupins, they don't get very tall. I'm now listing a lot of plants that would be suitable for dry spots that are in full sun. So if she has a wet spot that's in full sun, I think we'd go in a different direction. But hopefully it's a dry spot, because those low-growing plants are in dry spots, usually they don't get very tall. And if you've got a lot of moisture in the soil, things can start getting kind of a lot taller.
All right. Well, let's go to Bill in Fond du Lac next. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I have a question. I have an embankment, and it's about 150 feet long. It's about a 45-degree angle, and it's maybe about, the slope is probably about 8 feet in length. It faces the east side, and I'm wondering, I've been cutting grass on there for years, but, you know, it's getting a little bit more difficult every year just to go up and down that slope. And I do have a four-wheel drive lawnmower, but I thought if I ever would kill that grass off, what would be a good plants to put on the embankment to stop erosion? I did think of some little blue stem, and that'd be a lot of plants to put in. And I guess that'd just be my question. What would be a good thing if I could kill the grass off and plant something mm-hmm. that would native or whatever, something that would kind of keep the soil together and I wouldn't have to cut grass?
Yeah. I think your idea about little blue stem is a good suggestion. I wouldn't remove the lawn grass like to soil, and then, you know, because then you're going to get a lot more erosion. It could be that you could overseed or plant into that turf, and not especially if you have a dry period. You know, if you do it during a dry period, and then the native plants could eventually take it over. It might look a little rough in the meantime, but, you know, in the intermediate time. But yeah, I think if you seeded it heavily, that would be a good option. You could cut it low and then seed. And I need to think a little bit more about the timing of that in terms of your I assume it's just a bluegrass type of lawn grass type of turf grass there now. But I'll tell you what, if you would like to, I'll think about that a little more. If you'd like to email me at the Arboretum, then I can go into that in a little more depth with that project, because I want to think about the timing and the sequence of doing that. You don't want to leave that slope, that's a steep slope, and you don't want to leave it bare without without anything on it for a while, even in that transition period. So I want to think about that transition a bit more.
Okay. Thank you, Bill, for calling. You can join in, too. The number 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments, or email at ideas@wpr.org. Renee and Nina emailed that she puts a chair by her honeyberries and watches the bumblebees. Honeyberries blossom early, and the bees love them.
Oh, that's great. Now all I have to suggest is she get a camera to take a few pictures and send them in to Bumblebee Brigade.
Yeah, let's go back to Bumblebee Brigade for just a minute. What, sure. How do people maybe re-explain it again a little bit for those who may have tuned in late and then talk about how they can get involved?
Right. Well, it is a project for really anyone to participate in. And what it's in its fourth, we're starting the fourth year now, and it's a project from the Wisconsin DNR. So the purpose is to teach a lot about bumblebees, and we have 20 species of bumblebees in Wisconsin, one of them federally endangered, that's the rusty patch bumblebee, and then a number of others that are declining populations or they're quite rare, and then a number of fairly, you know, medium to fairly common species, and then a few that we know nothing really to speak of, we know nothing about them. So the purpose of this project is to have people all over the state start looking at their bumblebees and start documenting what they're seeing in their gardens or their yards or parks or any place they travel in the state. And then there's a way, if you join the Bumblebee Brigade, there's a website, and they will send you updates every month or so. And especially as the season gets going in mid-April, you'll be able to look at that website and learn some of the ways to, you know, success, the ways you can successfully take pictures of bumblebees and submit them to the website. Then on the website, if you submit a picture, your identification of the bee will be checked, and you'll be able to learn, I have this species and that species, and you can learn what they look like and how to identify them even more advanced way. A lot of the lessons and trainings, which of course are not being held in person right now, are available on the website. So it's kind of, you can kind of go there yourself and learn a bit more in depth about the project. And then what's created afterwards is a map of all the sightings. So last year, I believe there were 4,000 sightings that were reported on the website. And this was, you know, during COVID times. So it's really growing. And the more information we have about the different areas of the state and about the different kinds of bumblebees, the more we can really work on their conservation and on protecting them. And a lot of the things that we've talked about with the callers today, pesticides and so forth. There's a lot of information about caring for and taking and conserving our state's bumblebees. It was pretty exciting to discover a rare bumblebee or an endangered bumblebee in your own yard. Lots of people have had that experience in our area, and then to contribute and share your data and just to get enthusiastic about it and share that with others is very, very rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take another call. Brian in Madison, your turn. Brian, hi.
Hi, I'm wondering what plants to attract parasitic wasps.
Wow. I'm going to suggest for you I think a book resource would be good for that. I mean, usually if you plant native plants, you're going to attract a whole range of insects that are either pollinators or, they feed on these plants, they depend on those plants, and then their parasites come, and then the parasites of those parasites come, and so it creates a whole community. But there are some excellent resources. I'm sometimes just looking at the native plant nursery information. You'll pick up a few tips, but there are some books that might be more helpful than that. Attracting benefit, farming with native beneficial insects is one that comes to mind. So I would recommend that you look at the Xerces Society website, that book that I just mentioned, Native Beneficial Insects, is a Xerces publication, a book produced by them. So Xerces is spelled X E R C CES Society, and they are an invertebrate conservation organization. So pollinators, insects, anything without a backbone is in their portfolio to conserve. And they have excellent resources on their website, and also these books, which are, you know, kind of books that you can purchase, but they're all presented there. So I would go straight to that website and look for that, look for some of those resources.
There you go, Brian. Thank you. Kevin in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Good afternoon. I have a property with a fair amount of, it's fairly timbered, but I'd like to get some privacy, a little bit of privacy and some greenery. So last year I planted a dozen Canadian hemlocks.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've got another section of my property that I would like to plant some kind of privacy thing. And I really like the Canadian hemlocks. I'm getting a little long in the tooth to be growing something that grows that slow, but nonetheless, I like them. And is there a problem with, another half a dozen or a dozen Canadian hemlocks? I'm always kind of wary of getting too much of one species.
Well, that is a good concern. Have you had any difficulties with the ones you have? Is it a good?
No,
okay.
Perfect. I mean, they're only a year old, but no, they look good.
Yeah. One thing about the hemlocks, and I don't know if you have deer in your area, but that might be they usually do quite a bit of damage to hemlocks. But that aside, I think I like your idea or your instinct to diversify the planting a bit. So if you go into your next phase of planting, you might want to go with some other species. And if you need it, an evergreen, of course, that would be a consideration. If you don't need it evergreen, in other words, if you want, you know, if you can use deciduous, then you might go with kind of a mixed hedgerow idea. And use these different shrubs. Some of the things we had been talking about earlier. Some of the dogwood and the hazelnut, the nine bark, and those kinds of things, depending on your soil moisture, and match those shrubs in a kind of hedgerow situation. Because then, first of all, they're going to grow fast, and you won't have to wait too long for them to get pretty good sized, and they'll provide some screening, but also some other wildlife benefits as well. So that's something to consider.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Kevin. Jamie Sue in Campbellsport. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for the show.
You bet.
So I have a project I've been thinking about for a number of months now, and I'm trying to get some more ideas on how to diversify a fallow field, about an acre, I'd like to plant a prairie there, but I want to get away from, you know, rounduping the whole entire field and then starting over. It's mostly forage grasses, smooth brome, timothy, some orchard grass. There's no reed canary or any real, like, threatening invasives, but I just want to get some diversity in this field without spraying it. So any suggestions would be great.
I guess the question I would have on this is how fast do you want to see? I mean, sometimes people want to have the results really fast, and that ends up being one reason that they use, more severe methods of preparation. So if you could do planting similar to what I had described earlier, which is you could mow it low and overseed it, and try that. You could try different things on different spots of it to see what would work. You could plant into a spot, and have those plants. Spread and seed from there. That's a long-term kind of project. There are experts on prairie, old field prairie restoration that do this kind of thing all the time. So I'm thinking of Rich Henderson, the prairie enthusiast here in the Madison area, as someone who would be a really good resource for this. So I might suggest you get in touch with a group like Prairie Enthusiast and really like approach it as a mini restoration. And then, you know, with the specification that you'd rather not do it with a Roundup.
Yeah.
A Roundup even at the beginning.
Yeah, they're very, very helpful. I think it Prairie Enthusiast would be a good place to go,
it's
Jamie.
It's like a very small prairie restoration. I think that would be the way to think about it.
Thank you for calling. Good luck. John in Waukesha, hello.
About 5 years ago, I had a very interesting summer with a bumblebee in my backyard. And it was, you know, early summer, was warm out. And there was like one big black and yellow bumblebee and a couple of smaller ones. Well, this thing would find me wherever I was eventually working in the yard. I don't know if it's like the smell of aftershave or shower soap, but it would come buzz around me. And I would do the drill, stand still until it checked me out, and then it left. Well, one day I'm sitting on a bench with the paper and a cup of coffee around 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, and sure enough, I hear the buzzing. I look up, and there it is. So it comes and buzzes around in front of me, and then it circles around to the right of my head, goes behind me, and I feel this tremendous breeze on the back of my head. And I'm thinking, wow, I didn't know bumblebees could stir the air that much. So as it goes back behind my head and off to the left, I start to turn my head to the left and look, and it is being chased by a hummingbird. As the bumblebee went up and down, so did the hummingbird. And that's where this tremendous fan blast of air came. I guess it was just having some fun. Didn't look like it was aggressive because, you know, hummingbirds don't eat bumblebees, so they're very interesting experience.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great story. You know what? That's a great story to end on today. I love that story. So, thank you, John. And Susan, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to your next visit. And everybody go online to the Arboretum website and take a look at the plant sale that's coming up. You can make your orders pretty quick now. Susan, thanks again.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Susan Carpenter, Senior Outreach Specialist at the UW-Madison Arboretum. She'll be back again. We'll talk with her. Monday at 11, we'll take a look at industry standards for packaging and recycling. And then at 11:45, WPR Director Mike Crane is back to talk about what's new and take your questions and your comments on Monday on the Ideas Network on the Larry Mueller Show. I hope you have a great weekend, but stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.